Okay. So yesterday you heard a lot about some of these methods, and today I hope to tell you a little bit about some of the work that we've done in applying these to understand cognition in the brain, as well as its development and some of the ways that it can become altered in clinical populations. So just to give you a quick overview, I'm going to discuss the role of the synchronization is believed to play in functional integration in the brain. Then I'm going to talk about how that has been applied to study cognition and conscious perception. And then I'm going to talk a little bit to how this has been advanced to try to understand subtle cognitive developmental difficulties in populations such as preterm children, as well as more serious conditions affecting child health like epilepsy. So the reason that neuroscientists are primarily interested in neural synchronization is because it addresses the problem of functional integration. And this has been at least originally appreciated in the realm of feature binding. And by that, I mean when you look at an object like this pointer, you see that this has motion, it has color, it has shape, and contrary to Descartes' intuition, there is no convergent zone in the brain. There is no place where all of that information comes together and gets reassembled into this percept. Instead, it's represented by the activity of a distributed group of neurons which are spread around different brain areas. What was observed, most famously by Wolf Singer and his colleagues, is that when neurons which code the various features of a common object, they synchronize, and they usually synchronize around 40 hertz or in the gamma range. So this has been related to functional integration. And what's been observed in a subsequent set of studies done by many groups is that this is not only related to only feature binding, but it seems to be a very general phenomenon in the sense that when two sets of neurons, two cortical areas, et cetera, are required to participate for motor control, to code perceptual features, or to create a task-dependent network to support cognition, that the neural oscillations in those brain regions or neural populations become synchronized. So you see this cognition, action control, you see this in perception, you see the emergence of these adult-like patterns of neural synchronization during tasks coincides with psychological development during childhood and adolescence, and you see that many pathological conditions have corresponding alterations in oscillatory neural synchronization. So this has led to the view that this may be a very general phenomenon for how functional connectivity is able to be dynamically reassigned in the central nervous system. And this is general not only in terms of the domains that it seems to be relevant for, but also in terms of scale, in the sense that task-dependent neural synchronization has been observed all the way from the level of single-unit recordings up to large-scale interactions between distributed brain regions, like what we would pick up using EEG or MEG. And here's how it's been proposed to work. When two neurons or two neural populations are oscillating in synchrony, they can consistently exchange bursts of action potentials. What that means is that they can influence one another's behavior with greater effectiveness and communicate with greater fidelity, effectively by avoiding the refractory period of the receiving neurons or neural populations. So one of the first reasons we got interested in this phenomenon was the question of consciousness. How does the brain produce the mind? And the reason that we thought that neural synchronization may be related was proceeding from asking what are some of the core phenomenological attributes of conscious experience. And I think one of the people who's hit on some of the key features best is Giulio Tononi in his Information Integration Theory of Consciousness, where he says that consciousness is integrated in the sense that of feature binding. When you experience this object, you don't experience a disparate set of motion, color, form, etc. Perception is integrated. It's dynamic. What you're conscious of right now is not what you were conscious of 10 minutes ago, and maybe not what you're going to be conscious of 2 seconds from now. And it's selective. And what that means is that out of the plethora of the gigantic repertoire of potential conscious experiences or states that your brain could support, what you are experiencing at this moment is a very specific and selective selection of that. And to demonstrate that, you need only to shift your attention to me, to some other location of the room, or to shift your attention to the memories of last night or some other event. So it's not only on a philosophical level that we think this might be related, but it also appears that experimental evidence suggests that such a relationship may exist as well. So increased gamma synchronization accompanies coherent perception, feature binding, conscious detection of at-threshold stimuli, and it's also very closely aligned with mental functions such as short-term and working memory, which we think are very closely aligned with conscious experience. So the way we tested this is using binocular rivalry. So for those of you who don't know, this is an odd phenomenon where if you present incongruent visual stimulation to each eye in the same area of visual space, what you see is not what you might expect, a blend of the two, but typically flipping back and forth between percept one and percept two. And people have looked at this as an experimental window into conscious experience. And the reason for that is because unlike most stimuli, you have changes in conscious perception without any change in the underlying stimuli itself. So what we had is we just recorded EEG, where we had people view these rivaling stimuli and just press buttons to indicate when the perception was flipping from one to another. And we assumed that we'd see some sort of gamma synchronization integrating the features of the new percept when it came up. Yep. Yep. Yeah, so what we do is we use a mirror stereoscope, which essentially, so there's two images on a screen, and then there's a series of mirrors, which essentially pass the image of this stimulus to one eye and the image of that stimulus to the other eye. Yeah, essentially you rotate the angles of the mirror so that you have two images that overlap in visual space but are presented to each eye. And what you experience is an alternation. So you can just press the buttons to time lock the EEG to the perceptual alternation, essentially. Right, so just to give you a sense of the way that we process our data, and this will be similar to the data processing that will be used for a lot of these experiments, is we recorded EEG data, calculated scalp current density, extracted from a sparse montage of 19 evenly spaced electrodes just to mitigate the influences of volume conduction and so forth, narrowly bandpass filtered at 1 hertz intervals from 6 to 60 hertz, and then we used the Hilbert transform to basically reconstruct the envelope amplitude and the instantaneous phase for narrowband oscillations at each electrode at each time point. Then we used phase locking values to look at whether or not the synchronization among EEG electrodes was there or not. So the easiest, I think that this audience needs little explanation, but if you think about two oscillators, two narrowband signals at two electrodes over different parts of the brain, you can see that these are demonstrating low phase locking, supposedly indicating low functional connectivity, whereas conversely, these represent two signals that are showing high phase locking and indicating high functional connectivity of underlying cortex. And we standardized this relative to a baseline period to get sort of task-dependent changes in interregional synchronization in the EEG. And here's what we found. So this is time. This is time. And this is frequency, and this is synchronization averaged overall 171 electrode pairs in the 19-channel EEG montage. And this is time lock to the button press, so time lock to the motor response indicating a change in perceptual consciousness. And as we expected, we did see this sort of global increase in long-range phase synchronization, which we thought would be the integration of the new percept, which was the new conscious experience. So that supported our hypotheses, but what we didn't expect was we found that this is actually situated in an ongoing train of periodic recurrent gamma band synchronizations, which is not something that we expected at the time. We expected one. So as you can see, there's also some theta synchronization, which seems to be sustained. Yep.
So the y-axis
is frequency? This is frequency, yeah, and time.
Mm.
Sorry, perhaps I didn't unpack that properly. We did narrowband filtering at 1 hertz intervals from 6 to 60 hertz. So we would filter at 6 hertz, 7 hertz.
Where's the width of the band?
So the width of the band is F times plus or minus 0.05 times the filter frequency, essentially. So in order to optimize this trade-off between frequency resolution, it basically gets wider as the frequency goes higher. And the reason for that is because in terms of the neurophysiology experimental evidence, it seems like a lot of the high-frequency activity seems to be very transient and very periodic, so it's very important to capture the time course, whereas that's not as true for the low-frequency synchronization. And some people have shown, you know, developmental effects that are differential in high alpha versus low alpha. So we thought that it was important to adapt the sort of trade-off between the temporal and the spectral accuracy. That's standard. That's basically a Z-score. So these are essentially Z-score relative to a baseline interval, which is here. Okay. So it's remote from what we assumed would be very temporally remote from the button press. So we thought about this, and especially about why the gamma synchronization that corresponds to perceptual change would be situated in this ongoing train, and tried to figure out what it meant. And this is the best that we could come up with. We thought about the idea that there could be sort of end-to-end phase locking, harmonic relations among the rhythms of the brain. So what we thought might be occurring is that you might, just in your ongoing brain patterns, show periodic instances of long-range gamma band synchronization, and that these may be essentially mediated by an underlying theta rhythm. So what that essentially meant was that when you were in this unusual experimental viewing condition where the percept could alternate at any time, you tended to alternate at a particular transition from one gamma oscillatory ensemble to another. And there is some other evidence that has come up more recently to support the idea that this might be the case. So for example, people have used TMS and then looked at sort of the cycle of the ongoing low-frequency rhythm and shown that the perception of a phosphine just depends on whether or not what phase the low-frequency oscillation is, suggesting that, another example would be the attentional blink, which is to say if you present sequential visual stimuli faster and faster and faster, eventually you'll essentially drop perceptions. You'll see stimulus 1 and stimulus 3, and stimulus 2 will just essentially perceptually not exist for you. And the time frame at which that attentional blink phenomenon becomes apparent is consistent with the theta rate. So in any case, we wanted to test that and also to try to figure out the neural network that was mediating this. So we repeated the binocular rivalry experiment using these stimuli, reconstructed the gamma band activity, time locked to the button press, and what we found was, and then basically this is the gamma band activity, and we took the unconventional approach of looking at this sort of basically the peaks of this recurrent gamma oscillatory activity relevant to the interposed trough. So essentially, theoretically taking this and this and normalizing it to that. And here's what we found. So just to unpack this a bit, these are the two frequencies, the two gamma peaks, normalized to the interposed gamma trough. And we use beamform resource localization to reconstruct the gamma band activity, and then reconstructed the time series of the source activity and calculated gamma band phase locking in the manner which I described above. So what we found was recurrent activation in a distributed neural network that involved prefrontal cortex and posterior parietal cortex, and we also found that there was interregional synchronization. So what we thought was there was this sort of distributed network that might be mediating gamma perception through this gamma coherent perceptual network that was recurring at a theta rate, and that was its topography. So to get inside that a little bit more, we essentially reconstructed the source activities within that network and then looked at essentially the time frequency evolution of both the envelope amplitude and the interregional synchronization. So here is the gamma band, sort of like the average gamma coherence among the activated nodes in that network. And this is time relative to button press and frequency. And again, we see this evidence of this recurrent gamma band synchronization into which the perceptual switch is time locked. And this is the amplitude within the network, where we see this sort of this waxing and waning of gamma activation within this distributed perceptual network. And we decided that we wanted to nail down the evidence for this rather unusual effect a little bit better. So essentially what we did is we sorted the gamma band amplitude from the sources and the gamma band interregional phase locking value according to the phase of the theta rhythm, and then used surrogate statistics to establish statistical thresholds, and essentially showed that indeed what you see is you see a statistically significant modulation of network activity and network interregional integration by low frequency rhythms. So this brought us to the question of selective attention. Because one of the things that attention does is it biases information for inclusion in experience and consciousness and for higher processing, involvement in sort of a higher order executive network. So we just used a very well-proven Posner queuing paradigm. So for those of you that don't know, basically you're sitting there the whole time, you attend to the center of the screen, an arrow comes up to make you covertly attend to either the left or the right side, and then a target appears. And then you respond to the target if it's in the right place. And what we looked at was this activity in the cue target interval. So when you're looking straight ahead, but you've essentially shifted your visual attention to one side of the visual field. And what we found was a transient lateralization of long-range gamma band synchronization. So these are the EEG electrodes. There's the nose up there, and this is the back of the head. And what you can see is between the contralateral visual cortex, the visual cortex representing the attended field of visual space, and other areas, you're seeing this increased long-range synchronization. So what we thought that might represent is that might represent the selection of the integration of the attended brain areas representing the attended areas of space into a higher brain area. So basically selectively integrating the information that you're attended. What didn't make sense was that it was a transient response. So this person was attending to one side of the screen for a full second, and they were showing electrophysiological benefits of that attention after a second, but this appeared at around 300 milliseconds and then it was gone. So it didn't seem to be sustained. So we wanted to look a little bit closer. So we took advantage of some nice work done by our colleagues, Jess Green and John McDonald. And what they did is they basically did some very nice EEG beamformer to localize a distributed attention control network that showed a lot of congruence with what fMRI and other studies had shown previously. And we just reconstructed the activity within this network and looked at synchronization amongst the regions in the attention control network. And what we found was that between early occipital cortex and posterior parietal cortex, we saw a sustained lateralization of alpha band synchronization. So you can see this is represented by the blue and the red. And interestingly, I don't know the familiarity with the EEG literature, but it's been very well established that when you attend to one side of the visual field, you get alpha increases over the ipsilateral cortex as local alpha is related to idling or inhibition. And what we showed is basically a functional dissociation of alpha synchronization across scales, in the sense that in early occipital cortex, consistent with many of the other papers that have been written on this subject, we saw this increase over ipsilateral and decrease over contralateral, inhibition of to-be-ignored information, where we saw the opposite pattern in terms of long-range synchronization between higher and lower visual cortex, interregional synchronization and functional integration, similar to what's been seen previously with gamma oscillations. So now I just want to sum up what we think we found, the main points of what we think we found with that exploration into basic consciousness and visual cognition, it seems like we visual perception is subtended by a large-scale oscillatory ensemble consistent with what other people have proposed, and the gamma and theta oscillations seem to be important in that. Attention seems to be involving synchronization of oscillations across frequencies and probably biasing them for inclusion in some sort of network that's mediating perception and higher processing, and that alpha may be relevant to the maintenance of networks over longer periods of time, perhaps low frequencies in general. So now I want to just pivot to the second leg of this, which is how can this approach to understanding the mind be used to understand the development of the mind and its alteration in clinical populations? So here's some relatively recent work, e.g. work by Wolf Singer's group, which shows that in a basically perceptual paradigm, the synchronization and the oscillatory responses mature throughout childhood, and this shows some relation to the development of the perceptual apparatus. So we know that neural synchrony is associated with ability during development and just in general, and we know that there's abnormal synchronization in psychiatric conditions, and that this is certainly true of clinical conditions affecting childhood learning, like attention deficit disorder, ADHD, and so on. What we were specifically interested in is the problem of preterm children. So this is a problem of escalating consequences, because although the ability to save the lives of preterm infants has increased dramatically in recent decades, the ability to understand why these children are at risk of increased impairment has not. And what's being increasingly appreciated in these kids is that they're at risk of higher risk of things like cerebral palsy, brain damage at birth, etc. But even amongst the children who are classified as normal, there are some selective developmental difficulties which persist, such as difficulties in executive function, visual perceptual ability, and we really don't have a very good handle on why. What are the underlying neurological reasons why these selective difficulties are occurring? So to get at that, we used a longitudinal cohort of very preterm children and recorded MEG during the visual short-term memory task and just some spontaneous activity as well. So I'll start off with the visual short-term memory. We used a pretty simple task. So basically the child saw an initial stimulus. They were required to remember that, sort of hold that in their mind's eye for about a second. Then they saw a second stimulus, and they were required to press buttons to indicate if the two are the same or different. And what we were interested in is this area in between the first and the second stimulus, because other groups have shown reliable patterns of long-range synchronization at multiple frequencies that have been theoretically related to integration within this distributed neural ensemble that's maintaining the memory trace. So just to give you a quick idea of our processing, we standardized the head location within and across subjects, got rid of artifacts using a PCA-based procedure, extracted data from a 19-sensor montage similar to EEG, and looked at phase locking between sensors. So this is our group for the short-term memory, basically a longitudinal group of school-age preterms and controls. As I mentioned before, no major neurological or intellectual impairment. So first, the controls. So what you're looking at here is, again, during the delay phase of the task, in between the first and the second stimulus, while they're trying to remember that first image, hold that in their mind's eye. And this is phase locking relative to baseline, and this is frequency from 4 to 60 hertz in the controls. And what we find here is very reminiscent of what other groups have found using adults, such as the Palva group in Helsinki, where we see distinct increases in phase locking in multiple what are understood to be functionally distinct frequency ranges, theta, alpha, beta, and gamma. And here's the topography of the long-range alpha synchronization, which seems to show a strong frontal posterior orientation, which makes sense given that we know working memory involves cooperation between executive monitoring functions in prefrontal cortex with visual representational areas in posterior parietal cortex. So we found something different when we looked at the preterms, more different than I expected. So as you can see, there is a rather distinct difference around where the canonical 10 hertz alpha peak is for the controls, and it almost looks as if there's a second peak. This is averaged across all sensor pairs, and there seems like there's an average peak here, a second peak, which is looks almost like the alpha peak has been slowed into the theta range. And when we looked at just interhemispheric connections, where the topography of the differences seemed most concentrated, that difference was significant. And we know that preterm children have altered development of corpus callosum. Whether or not this is related to it, we don't know. But an important thing to understand about this analysis as well is that we only included correct trials. So this is analysis of only the trials on which the preterm children got the answer right, and only the trials on which the full-term children got the answer right. Which is to say, it's not just that their brain is not working as efficiently at this task, because we know that. They have selective difficulties. This is to say that even when the preterm children are getting it right, their brains are doing something different. The underlying connectivity dynamics are successfully implementing this in a different way. So this gets to this issue of some subtle neurological neonatal insult that is not being detected, and either compensatory reorganization or some sort of subtle reconfiguration of brain networks. And what I thought was possibly most interesting about this is that when we looked at among the that alpha synchronization, where that difference was most pronounced in the preterm children, it was correlated with accuracy on the task, and it was also correlated with visual perceptual ability assessed after the task with the Beery VMI psychometric assessment. And importantly, these correlations were not seen with the full-term controls, and they were not seen with general full-scale IQ. So what that suggests is that this approach of MEG neural synchronization may reveal the neural basis of selective difficulties which are subtle in developmental populations. Okay, so now I want to just move quickly to some of the work we've been doing on focal epilepsy at SickKids. And just to give you some background, there's in cases of drug-resistant epilepsy, surgery is often used to remove the areas that are responsible for starting the seizure, and this is sometimes effective. And there's been an increasing appreciation more recently, and in SickKids in particular, that the location of excessive high-frequency oscillations is related to the location of epileptogenic cortex, and that removal of those brain regions is related to increased surgical success. So here's just sort of a time frequency of for an activity of an electrode, one of these electrodes which are placed surgically onto the surface of the brain prior to surgery. And here, so this is frequency and this is time. Here's the electrode grid, this electrode grid from an individual patient. So essentially what's being done is they look at the topography of where these high frequency oscillations are being expressed, and then they take that brain area out, which has been associated with better success than previous methods, but still not perfect success. So given what you heard yesterday, the implication of altered connectivity patterns in epileptic networks, what we were interested in doing is looking at the relationship between HFOs and network connectivity. So we looked at the HFOs, we looked at inter-electrode synchronization, and graph theoretical measures predicated on those phase synchronization. So this is really the work of George Ibrahim, who's come up with the first evidence, really, that increased high-frequency oscillations in focal childhood epilepsy are related to high-frequency disconnection. So here, these are individual correlations for a group of subjects with focal cortical dysplasia, and this is statistically significant at the group level. When George contrasted the synchronization properties involving electrodes within the seizure onset zone, shown here in the solid line, it's difficult to see, it's with non-seizure onset zone, what he found was an interaction between connectivity and frequency. Specifically, seizure onset zone was functionally disconnected at high frequencies, but hyperconnected at low frequencies. And we think that this makes sense in terms of what is being seen in individual patients and individual seizure events. Here's something that was pulled up by Ayaka Ochi, which actually is turning out to be typical in at least the few kids that we've looked at so far. So these are electrodes, which are in the seizure onset zone shown here. And this is filtered greater than 80 hertz and less than 2 hertz, or 3 hertz, I think. So what we typically see is we see an ordered progression of events. So the initial bursts of high frequency local oscillatory activity, subsequently large bursts of low frequency activity, and then 3, shown here in purple, this is the EMG electrode, the seizure, the clinical semiology. So that there's an ordered high frequency activity, low frequency activity, seizure. And what we find is that this area, which is mapped primarily on the basis of high concentration of HFOs, in individual subjects also seems to be correlated with low-frequency hyperconnectivity and high-frequency disconnection. So this suggests that the high-frequency oscillations may participate in generating seizures through their involvement in a larger set of epileptogenic network dynamics involving high-frequency disconnection and low-frequency hyperconnectivity. And just to show you a little bit more of some of George's work here is, of course, given the first part of my presentation and this, you would assume that the natural question is, what is the relationship between all of these functional network dynamics, which we know are so closely related to cognition and consciousness, and altered in epilepsy? How does that relate to the problem of functional difficulties in epilepsy? Because children with epilepsy have a wide range of functional impairments, but the brain basis of that is not extremely well understood. So what George did was we map motor cortex using several means, but this is based on extraoperative stimulation. And what you're looking at here is the grid superimposed on the MRI, and for if you're interested, that's the radiographic lesion, and these are the MEG interictal spikes. But this is the extraoperatively mapped hand motor area, and he selected an ROI around the primary motor cortex and looked at relationships between synchronization involving motor cortex and function. And what he found was that ictal desynchronization, essentially differences in synchrony involving motor cortex contrasted during seizure versus an interictal baseline, was related to whether or not these children had a functional motor impairment. Pretty strong effect. And he also showed that there was a high correlation between this ictal dysfunction and psychometric assessment, neuropsychological assessment of motor function in the contralateral hand. Not so much the ipsilateral hand, and not general intelligence, like matrix reasoning, verbal IQ, things like that. So it seems like the invasion of eloquent cortex, specific functional neural systems, by this epileptic network connectivity is driving some of the functional difficulties that are associated with childhood focal epilepsy, which is to say, if during the seizure the atypical network activity goes into a particular functional area, motor, language, etc., it's going to cause a disturbance of the underlying connectivity that's allowing you to perform that function, and it's going to lead to impairment in that domain. So just to sum it up, I think we've shown some evidence that neural synchronization in distributed networks is related to perceptual experience, information processing and cognition, like selective attention. We have some evidence that this is related to both subtle impairments in cognition in populations like preterm children, as well as more severe impairments like childhood focal epilepsy. And where I think the next step is for this type of research is the use of some of these connectivity to really drill down on how can this be used to inform diagnosis and inform treatment. So, for example, can we use connectivity to map the location of epileptogenic cortex? And some other groups have made a lot, some impressive strides in the combination of connectivity dynamics with machine learning approaches for classification, identification of childhood neurological disorders. With that, I'd like to thank you for your attention and thank this long list of individuals and institutions for supporting our research.